Today's Teisho will be on case 37 in the U Men Kwan, the Mumong Kan, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 37 is entitled Joshu's Cypress Tree. A monk asked Joshu, "What is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming to China?" Joshu said, "The cypress tree in the garden." Mumon's comment: if you understand Joshu's answer intimately, there is no Shakya before you, no Maitreya to come. Mumon's verse: words cannot express things. Speech does not convey the spirit. Swayed by words, one is lost. Blocked by phrases, one is bewildered. Thank you so much for coming to practice Zen this morning on this beautiful winter's day. With snow coming down, sunny and snowy, all in one morning. Beautiful. I am a reader of the Huffington Post. And I often meditate in the morning, just about every day. And then I have breakfast. And while I'm eating my breakfast, I have developed a bad habit of reading the Huffington Post. And I read the political articles. And then when I run out of interesting things to read, I read the lifestyle page. And there's always an article on meditation and how meditation can help you on the job. And they're usually written by people who have done some meditation, but they really aren't, deeply committed. They might be like a psychologist, maybe a psychologist who works with business people to reduce stress, or a professor of management, things like that. And they write these articles about how you can use meditation as a tool for life, for living. One was actually entitled, Why CEOs Need Meditation. And I thought that was funny, because CEOs are the ones who create all that pressure. So if anybody doesn't need to get a relief from their pressure, it's probably the person at the top. But I see these articles all the time, and I'm very happy that people are interested in meditation, and I'm even happy that CEOs meditate. It's possible that if they meditate long enough, they will become kinder people. I definitely believe that if everybody really practiced this path, the world would certainly be a better place. I'm totally convinced of that. And I'm happy that people see meditation as a tool that they can use to live their life. So, you know, if you are under pressure and you have a big deadline and you have a big report and you sit down and you're so nervous about writing your report that you can't focus on writing, you know, it really is good to sit down and do some meditation. And if you're in a panic mode and you haven't meditated, it's not going to do you any good to try to learn how to meditate at that moment. You know, it's much better if you learn to meditate when you're not in a crisis and you begin to develop the capacity to enter deep concentration. You know, if you start meditating regularly, you know, you will you will be able to reach a point after about 15 minutes of meditation where you have a deep relaxation response, and you'll be able to feel all the tension and pressure draining away. And then if you continue to meditate, like another 15 minutes, you may begin to get to this place where you feel very grounded, very centered. We call this state samadhi. Very few thoughts flowing through your head, and you feel very grounded, very solidly planted on the ground. It's one way to experience it. If you get to that place, you can deal with the pressure, you know, maybe the anxiety you have about writing this report. And if you stay there for half an hour or you stay there for an hour, when you get off the cushion, you may find that you are calmer and able to cope a little better. You know, this has really been an incredible help to me. You know, I have been in jobs myself that are extremely stressful. When I first came to Rutgers, I was taking over a very large program right out of graduate school, basically. And the person who gave me the job was really hoping I would fail, so he would get a raise, the dean would give him a raise, and he would be put back in the job after I flopped. And that really happened. He hired me. He had gone to the dean and asked for a raise, and the dean said no, and he said, then I quit. So basically, he was hoping that nobody else could do this job, and he hired me, I think, under the assumption that I would wash out in about a year. I'm telling you the absolute truth. And this is true, too. When I went into the office, my new office, all his stuff was still there. He didn't even move his books and things out of the office because he didn't think I was going to last. And he went on a leave of absence for a year and left all his stuff in what was supposed to be my office. The message was clear. You know, and I had run a little program at the University of Washington when I was a graduate student, but I hadn't done anything where I had to manage thousands of students and more than 200 people, teachers. There was the whole setup was so disorganized that I would get there at 8 in the morning and get home at 8 at night. And all the time I was trying to learn this job, you know, I was supposed to be publishing articles, which I didn't have time to write because I was trying to learn my job administering this program and trying to get it into shape because it seemed to be constantly in a state of emergency. So I can tell you, I did a lot of Zazen and it really helped. You know, I would be so stressed out sometime, just imagining that this whole thing was going to go crashing down, that I was unable to focus my mind. And I would sit down on the cushion and do some Zazen, and I would get up, and I would go on with my work. And I remember once Elaine Jones, she's retired now, but she was the administrative assistant in our office. And there was some crisis going on. There was always a crisis because it was so badly organized. The crisis was unfolding, and she brought it into me, and I just started breathing with Mahara. You know, and you ground yourself. Even eventually, if you do this, you can get into deep samadhi even when you're not on a cushion. You can just get into that deep samadhi mind. And I just sort of grounded myself in my samadhi mind and started working on the solution. And she said, you are so calm. How do you do this? I didn't share my secret with her. I don't think she would have understood. But it definitely is valuable in that way. But I still think something important is lost if we just reduce meditation practice to like a tool for living, you know? So it helps you cope with the stress, or it helps you cope with other challenges in life. Yes, definitely, absolutely. But there's a deeper dimension to all this, which is really, really important, and that it's easy to lose sight of. Yes, it is valuable. Yes, it does help us deal with stress. Yes, it does. You know, all of those things are true. You know, but then there's a larger set of questions, you could say, you know, about not just about can I get the report done, or will I be able to deal with this crisis at work, or the, you know, there's another dimension to practice that is really important. You know, meditation is, if we just think of meditation as a tool or a strategy or a technique, we really miss out on something that's very, very important, very crucial, really much more important, actually, even than getting the report done. You know, this happened, well, what is that? Well, you know, who are we? Where do we come from? And where are we going? Yes? I don't know if you've ever seen that famous painting by Paul Gauguin, but it's one of my favorite paintings in the world, and at least half of the reason I like the painting is the question. The title of the painting is three questions. Who are we? Where do we come from? And where are we going? And the painting is beautiful because it shows young people, you know, just like babies, children, spring, flowers in Tahiti. And then you go through all the stages of life, and it shows at the end a very old woman with gray hair, white hair. And, you know, in the corner, there's like this darkness, or there's like this dark presence, right? You think, oh, maybe that's death. So I think this is a really wonderful painting, and I think these are really important questions. Who are we? Where do we come from? And where are we going? You know, we're so busy doing our reports and rushing around and coping with stress that, you know, in a way we never have a chance to step back and take a larger view. Or these questions sort of we push to the margins of our consciousness, and we busy ourselves with everyday things. Sometimes, though, the questions, you know, force themselves upon us. Yeah. So here's something that actually happened. If you were here last night, there were two people who come to sit every Friday night. They've been coming for a couple of years. They usually can't come to sit on Saturday. Actually, I shouldn't have said two people, three people. They come almost every Friday night, and they have been for years. Two of them were here last night. The third one was missing, and he was missing for a reason. He actually was a teacher in the writing program, and his name was Dave. Dave, that's his name. He has been working in the writing program for a couple years now. He has a graduate degree in English. And he started working in my program around the same time he heard about our meditation group. So he and his friend Paul and Paul's sister would all come to sit on Friday night, and he was teaching in the program. So, you know, he did a wonderful job. You know, there are some people it's just a pleasure to work with. You know, he was very kind, intelligent, hardworking person. He got excellent student evaluations from his students, just semester after semester. I could always count on him to do an excellent job. In fact, we used him as a special tutor. We have cases where students are, they may have some kind of a learning disability or emotional problem, and we can't put them in a regular classroom because they can't cope with that environment. So some people, for example, have a slightly Asperger's spectrum problem, and the classroom is just too lively an environment. They can't focus their minds. But if it's one-on-one, they can do wonderful things. So, we have cases like that. You know, a student will show up in class and he's all over the place and there seems to be something wrong, and then we investigate and it turns out the student has some kind of a condition, and then we call Dave. And we give the student to Dave, and Dave can get these people through very demanding work, and they really love him, or they loved him. So anyway, on Wednesday, I have had a typical day. There was a meeting at 10 o'clock. So I got to my office around 9:15, and I went through my emails till my meeting, and then I went to this department meeting. And then at like 11:30, I got back, and I had to get ready for my next meeting. This is just part of my life. And I had a 1 o'clock meeting, and I was getting back to my emails, and I got a call from Paul. Paul is one of the people who meditates on Friday night. And he said, Dave is on campus, and he just called me, and he's feeling terrible. And he said he's behind Scott Hall. So he said, I've called 911, would you go look for him? So I got up and I raced out and I went to Scott Hall and I looked all around Scott Hall. He was supposed to be behind Scott Hall. If you know Scott Hall, there's an open area with grass and benches. And I didn't see him anywhere. So then I went into the parking lot, and I didn't see him. And then I went around to the front of the building, and I didn't see him. And I went back into the building, and I ran into campus security person. And he said, we've gotten a 911 call. And I said, you and I are looking for the same person. So, we walked out the back door looking for Dave. And then we noticed that there was a couple students, making a little circle around somebody sitting on the steps behind the language lab, the next building over. And we went over there. We sort of ran over there, and then the EMT people arrived in the ambulance, and it was Dave sitting on the steps, and he was white. He wasn't conscious. He dropped his phone, and they felt his pulse, and they couldn't really feel a pulse, so they tore his shirt open, they pounded his chest. We actually all lifted him onto a gurney. They put a heart monitor on him and whisked him off to the hospital, and on the way he died. So this guy was 54 years old, right? He was a wonderful human being, a compassionate, hardworking. Last night, Paul and his sister, who are really Dave's best friends, came to sit. And I was really surprised to see them because they've been dealing with Dave's death, and Paul has been calling me on the phone. After I sent Dave to the hospital, I called Paul back and said, I said I think he's going to make it. His heart was beating, and they took him to the hospital. So, I had to call Paul back and give him the bad news when campus security let us know that he hadn't made it. So we've been communicating on the telephone. And I didn't expect to see him. But he and his sister were both here last night. And, you know, understandably, they wanted to talk. And they said, you know, Paul said something really interesting. He said, I didn't plan to come here. You know, I really didn't plan to come here, but we just decided to come and sit. And I said, you know, I think you've really made a good decision. Because my personal feeling is that there's nothing anybody could tell you about this event that will make you feel better or come to terms with it, you know? You know, somebody could say to you, Dave has gone, this is a common way that, people try to help other people cope with this kind of a loss. Say, he has gone to a better place. Now, even if you believe he has gone to a better place, I actually don't think that's particularly helpful. It's nice to think about, but there's a big hole in your life all the same. You know, basically, the previous Friday, Dave was in this room meditating. And I saw him before the sit started. I slapped him on the back. He was laughing. In fact, Paul said the morning he got up, he called Paul. And he said, hey, man, you know, let's get together after we're done teaching, you know. And we'll go out to eat. And he was his jolly self, you know. So it's like 1 minute he was laughing and enjoying his life, and the next minute he has disappeared from the earth. We could say, well, he's gone to a better place or something. He was a wonderful person. You know, all of those ways of talking about the situation don't do anything about that big black hole in the middle of your life. I said, I'm so glad you have come here, because I actually think this is a very good way of dealing with the situation. You know, I said, what I have done in situations like this, I have been through this a number of times, you know. And I don't think there's anything anybody can say that's really going to make you feel better, is to sit down on the cushion, enter deep samadhi, and just sit with this event. Just be present with this event. And, when you give people this kind of advice, you don't know how it's going to work out. It's worked for me. It has worked for me. But you don't know if it's going to work for the other person. So, you know, I was hoping, you know, fingers crossed, this was going to work out for them. And then after it was all over, everybody left and we sat here and we talked for a while. And I said, how did that go? And Paul said, that was so wonderful. You know, and his sister said the same thing. She said, I really didn't think, I thought when I sat down on the cushion I was going to be overwhelmed with grief. But instead I feel so much more grounded. You know, I feel so much more grounded. I think this is, I'm glad I was able to help them. You know, it's helped me. My experience, you know, I've had a number of people in my family die. My brother was only 50 years old when he died, you know. So, when that kind of an event happens, you know, you can't really just keep being busy, you know. You can try to do your report, but it's, you know, probably that strategy of constant controlled distraction doesn't really work so well. In the face of an event like this, it really brings you, you know, right up close to those questions, right? Who are we? where do we come from and where are we going, you know? And we know we're going to die. You know, it's absolutely guaranteed. But we definitely push it off to the side. We definitely push it off to the side, even though I think it's really important. Really important. And when it happens, it's sort of like it can have the effect of like tearing a big hole in our life, and all the stories we tell suddenly go silent, you know. So, anyway, there's more to this practice than preparing the next, dealing with stress and preparing the next report. You know, this is like a different way to live your life. You know, live your life. When people in the West think about life, you know, we think about life. We think, you know, Western people think about it as like a road or a journey or like a pilgrimage, right? You know, so there's a beginning and there's an end, right? This is a sort of how, you know, we think about life in the West. Maybe there are people all over the world who think about this, but, you know, the road idea, life is a journey. Life is like a journey. This is a ancient way of thinking in the West about life. You know, if you ever have had the opportunity to read the Odyssey, you know, it's really a journey. It's like a metaphor or parable about life. You know, you start here and you end here. And you know, we are thinking in terms of where we're going and where we're going to end up. You know, and if you look at like the Odyssey, it's about this guy's journey, trying to get home, and all of the things that the dangers he has to face until he can get home, right? And if you read the Bible is really a story of people who are on a journey, you know, like Jewish people in exile, and then trying to get home. And the whole Bible is about, you know, mankind's road from creation to the end of the world. You know, so this way of thinking about life is as a road or a journey is one way to think about life. You know, even Gauguin thought about life that way. You know, we start as a baby and we end as a old person waiting for death. You know, that's one way to think about life. And, you know, when we think about life that way, we ask ourselves, well, okay, then it must, you know, we say to ourselves, it must have a meaning. What's the meaning? You know, and what we want to do in our life is to have a meaningful life. So as we're on the journey of life, we want our life to have meaning, yeah? And we try to give it meaning. It has to be like a story, and it has to have that kind of coherence. And it has to have a kind of message or point to it. This is the way we normally think about life. Life is a journey, it's a road, it has a meaning, and it has a destination. It's going somewhere, right? And so it's very important to go to the right place, the right direction, and to have a meaningful life. We say this all the time. And yet, you know, when I think about my friend Dave, if you sit down and you say, what was the meaning of all this? It's very hard to say, right? It's very hard. I mean, what was the meaning? Here was a guy who grew up in New Jersey. He and Paul were friends since elementary school. They both went to the same Catholic school. And Paul and his friend Dave both went to graduate school and studied English literature and got advanced degrees. They were probably hoping to get jobs as like English professors teaching, you know, the Odyssey or teaching Chaucer or Shakespeare. But the job market isn't very good. Wound up teaching composition. This is also what happened to me. So if you had asked them when they were going to graduate school, what do you want to do? They would say, I am going to be a teacher of English literature. I'm going to teach Shakespeare, Henry VIII, to undergraduates. And they will all adore me because I will be a great teacher of Shakespeare. And if you flash forward 10 years, they're at Rutgers teaching students how to write essays. Okay? So what's the meaning of that? What's the meaning? Okay? Paul and Dave, used to get together and work on their papers, grade their papers together and this sort of thing. They had a wonderful friendship. And they were both sort of settling in. Paul has a job at another place, and Dave was working here, and he loved Rutgers, and he loved the writing program, and he was starting an exercise program. He was trying to lose a little weight, and he was, really getting his feet on the ground. He felt like he had found a place he wanted to work in. He was enjoying the work. His students adored him. And he was on his way to teach, and he had a heart attack, and he died behind Scott Hall. So what is the meaning of that? If you think about the road, where did his road go? Right? Where did it go? And what was its meaning? My father, I could give you biographies of so many people. And you could say, when they're 20 years old, they will say, I'm going to be doing this when I am 50 years old. And that will be what gives my life meaning. But, when they're 50 years old, so often people are not doing what they thought they would be doing 20 years earlier or 30 years earlier. Life might not really be like a road with a beginning and an end. And it might not really have a meaning, even. Really. And this all could be very depressing if you cling to this way of thinking about life. What we want is a life that is, follows a predictable path. It works like this. You grew up splitting rails in a log cabin in Illinois. You became a self-trained lawyer. And you eventually became president of the United States, right? You saved the Union from collapse, and you ended slavery. You were assassinated, but, everybody adores you. Okay, that's the kind of story we would like to have told, right? My life is like that, right? But actually, even Lincoln didn't know where his life was going, And most lives don't look like that. You were born here, you thought you were going to do this, you wound up doing this, and then you lived to be 60 or you lived to be 80, and at the end of it you sit down and say, what was it all about? What did it mean? And you can comb it over and comb it over, but, it's not a story. Stories aren't real. Real life doesn't have a structure like that. Real life doesn't have a meaning like that. There isn't a point to your life. There isn't necessarily a message. People get terribly upset when they think, some people get terribly upset. I've actually had this discussion with people, and I've had people get furious at me. I mean, like, really angry. Like, you're a bad man. But if you think about it, I'm just being honest. Life doesn't work like a story. And then they all lived happily ever after, the end. Or, novels are not real. They're fictions. They're stories we tell ourselves. But life doesn't work like a novel. You get up one day, you're on your way to your job, you're about to get married, and somebody, you know, somebody hits you, and you're in the hospital. You know, this. You say, well, that doesn't happen forever. It happens all the time. That's called life, right? So, you know, all of this could be unbearable to think about. If you expect life to be like a story that has a plot line, a through line, you know, everybody wants to be the hero of his own story. We all have this desire, and we all want to be the hero of our own story. But when you look at other people's lives, you realize that, you know, really that hero idea is very unrealistic. You know, we aren't really we don't have that much control. And at the end of it all, when we look back, it's not like Abraham Lincoln, you know. It's just this happened, and 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 then it was over. And it's possible to find this terribly distressing, and very upsetting, right? But, you know, we don't have to live our life that way. Because I think when you live your life that way, it constantly creates anguish and unhappiness. Because life is going like water. It's going this way, and it's going that way, and it's going this way, and it's following its own mysterious path, you know? And you're the water, and you're going here, and you're going there, and you're, you know. But you don't control the process. But when you sit down and you say, what is the meaning of this? Where is my life going? It's going nowhere. It gets so, you could be so depressed by this, right? This is so depressing. So what does it all add up to? What does it all add up to? You know, I have met a fair number of people who at the end of their life are really quite bitter about this. You know, what does it all add up to? You know? So, that, you know, there's another way of living which is going to cause you a lot less grief and suffering. You know, and we practice this in a little way when we sit down on the cushion. We sit down on the cushion and you just watch your breath. You know, when you come in to meditate, you know, when you're beginning to meditate, you know, you're learning how to control your mind, so to speak. But really, it's not about controlling anything. You know, it's about being one with. Being one with. So, you know, when you're watching your breath, it's not about controlling your breath. It's about becoming one with the breath. Being one with. And, you know, the breath is the best teacher for beginning meditator. Because, you know, the breath is going to do what it wants to do. You know, there are traditions of meditation where you try to control the breath. You make it go out your left nostril, then you make it go out your right nostril, etc. You know, from the Zen standpoint, this is worse than futility. You know, this is like, getting in the way of a really important insight. So, you know, when you watch your breath, be the servant of your breath. You know, sometimes your breath is going to be long, and sometimes it's going to be short. Sometimes it's going to be thick, and sometimes it's going to be thin. Sometimes it's going to be as fine as spun gold, and sometimes it's going to be like sandpaper, right? And you can't change it no matter what you do. You know, you can't keep one hair on your head from turning gray or falling out. Believe me, I know this. You can't stop it. You can't stop it. So why try to stop it? Well, you try to stop it because it's supposed to go my life is supposed to go somewhere. It's supposed to end up, and he became president of the United States, right? It's supposed to be like that. But that's not really life. Life is like wild forest, right? It's just growing. It's just growing and going and going. And it's like water. It hits this rock and it goes around. And it hits this rock and it goes around. And you're along for the ride, right? You're along for the ride. And you watch your breath and you realize, look, you know, I can't even control my breath. I'm going to be one with my breath. When it's long, I'm going to go long. When it's short, I'm going to go short, right? You know, the art of meditation is not controlling anything. It's becoming one with. Becoming one with. You watch the breath and it takes you into this blank place. You didn't do it. It took you there. And you dwell in that blank place and your mind becomes deep, 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 deeply grounded in the moment, like this imperturbable calm, right? And when you're in that imperturbable place, you know, everything around you actually becomes so alive, right? So whatever it is, it's so alive when you're in your samadhi mind. You know, when we, you know, we recite in the morning at Sesshin, and here too on Saturdays, the Shinshin Ming, the verses on trust in mind. And it's to set up what you like against what you dislike is a disease, is a mental illness. So from the standpoint of Seng Tsan, the author of the verses on trust in mind, to live the way Western people live is an invitation to a mental illness. You know, my life is a road. You plan your path in life and you follow the path. You plan it out meticulously, you follow it. And at the end, it will be, you will achieve your goals, you will be President of the United States, and this will be the meaning. Now, Seng San says that is like an invitation to unhappiness. Don't live that way. If you live that way, you will be torn apart, as Lao Tzu says, you will be torn apart on the lathe of heaven. If you know what a lathe is, you know, a lathe is a device that turns a piece of wood, a long piece of wood, and you take a blade and you shape that piece of wood into like a chair leg or a table leg. And if you push the blade too hard, you break the block of wood. If you don't push it hard enough, it doesn't take off the layers of wood you need to take off. So a skillful lathe operator puts a little pressure on, but not too much. And Lao Tzu says, if you try to control your life, you will be torn apart on the lathe of heaven. You know, you want to go in this direction, but your life is pushing you in that direction. That could be the occasion for great suffering, or it could be the occasion for great joy and learning. Which will it be? To set up what you like against what you dislike is the disease of the mind. You know, my father-in-law went to a doctor and had a complete cardiovascular checkup. I swear this is true. And he got a bill of health. And like a month later, he had a massive heart attack and almost died. I swear that's the truth. And you know, it was like, how did that happen, right? But, you know, you can't control anything. You do your best, and then you see where you wind up. This doesn't mean you should quit medical school. Doesn't mean you should quit your job. But think about it. How much do you control? Now, you know, not controlling things is the way of the world. You know, my friend Dave got up and he got his lessons ready. He had his graded papers in his satchel, which I have sitting in my office. He was on his way to his class, probably playing over his lecture, right? His lesson plan. And then a heart attack happened. And he's 54 years old, right? He couldn't control it. You know, we see the body lying on the stairs, you know, we want to say, well, that's not me. I, however, have control. But that is not true. It is an illusion. And instead of being an illusion that will help you, it's an illusion that will hurt you. You know, living this, like being one with things as they unfold, I would say, is a superior way of life. It brings joy and freedom from worry and you know, false comparisons, right? You know, I have a friend of mine who is, we both went to graduate school together. We sat in the same classes, right? And my friend is like, has a distinguished chair of something, some, you know. He's a nice guy. He's a pretty smart guy, I have to say. You know, he speaks about 6 languages. You know, it's possible for me to make myself really ill because I don't have a titled chair, you know. And believe me, the academic world is full of people who can barely get out of bed in the morning because they don't have one. I'm not kidding. You know? And this is so unnecessary, right? You know, so unnecessary. There's so many things we don't control. You know, the year he went out on the job market with his new dissertation, it turned out that his dissertation just happened to be a very hot topic that year. And he was whisked away to this very good university where he had like a 1-1 teaching load and he could write and write and write. And, you know, I, however, wrote a dissertation that nobody wanted to read, you know. Actually, a very good dissertation, I would say. My committee thought it was very good. It's in the library at the University of Washington, and you can check it out. I'm sure it hasn't been checked out in 40 years. But actually, a very good I think it's a very good dissertation, you know. It just wasn't hot that year. So he taught a 1-1 load, and I taught a 9-course load a year, right? Okay. So he got a lot more work done than I did. Now, it's possible to, you know, blame myself. You know, why didn't I choose that topic? Why did I choose this topic? That way of living is an invitation to misery, to absolute misery. You know, the lesson of Zazen is so important. We don't control anything. It's not about control. Humans don't need to practice getting control. They try morning, noon, and night to control everything. And by the way, look how well it's going. President Trump? Global warming? Maybe what we need is less control. Right? We want control. We're such a fearful little simians, yeah? That we want to control everything, but it's not necessarily good for us. This universe is a big machine, much smarter than we are. If we trust it, we can be very happy, very creative, very lively monkeys, right? If we try to control everything, we close the door on we build a cage around ourselves. You know, we are monkeys who build a cage around themselves. So, you know, to practice the great way of Zen is not to practice, this is not about controlling anything. You know, the secret to sitting well is not trying to sit well, but just to be present, just to be one with your breath. If you have pain in your leg, you know, you just have to be one with the situation. If you imagine a better situation, the pain becomes unbearable. If you say, this is the world right now, it goes away. I swear to you, it just goes away. If you can enter deep samadhi and just fuse yourself with what is unfolding around you, when I sit down on a cushion, I have been doing this, you know, I, like everybody else, want to control everything. I do too. It's the human way, you know. I would like to control this and this and this and. You know, but when I sit down on the cushion, you know, I let it go. You let it go. You can't control it. And you just let things unfold. And when I do this, sometimes I sit down on the cushion, it's like a bomb going off, like this energy, just this fountain of energy gushing up. And getting in touch with that energy is easy to do if you learn how to get out of the way. You know, letting it go. Letting it go. And this, I think this life, this is like the fountain of life. The fountain of youth, energy, joy. You know, I can't wait to get to the cushion because I just let it go. And this sometimes it's like this bomb going off. It's just, where is this energy coming from? My idea is that it's here all the time. We just close it off. We close it off. You know, trying to control things is an insidious habit. And it makes us blind to everything around us. So, you know, we don't really know how, what went on in Dave's life, you know. But, you know, nothing he did could have changed the outcome. I was talking to Paul last night, and Paul said, oh, if only I'd done this instead of that. It's like, that's crazy talk, right? That's crazy. You know, his number was up. I didn't put it that way. But it's time. It was his time. You know, if you had called the EMT 5 minutes earlier, it would not have helped. He had a massive heart attack, you know. And you know, this happens to people all the time. There's nothing, it's going to happen when it's going to happen. I take my car to a place called GT Japanese Automotive in Edison. And when I first took it there, there were two brothers, Bill, and Bill is still there, and he's a nice guy, but he's a little bit glum. There was like the glum brother and the happy brother. And the happy brother was great. Bill was always the sourpuss, and his brother was this lively, friendly guy who actually, we got to talking about meditation, and he said, do you teach meditation? Yes, I do. He was going to come over here and sit, and he never came. And I thought, well, maybe he found another group. So I took my car in, and there was Bill, and I said, where's Tom? And he said, Tom must have been in his early 40s. He said he was on a bicycle race, and he had pulled over, and he had a heart attack, and he died. So, you know, fit, very fit, athletic, happy, you know. You would think, okay, here's the happy one, here's the unhappy one. You know, who is going to go first? The happy one. Here's the one who sits in a chair all day, here's the one who gets exercise. Who is going to go first? The one who gets exercise. There's no sense trying to figure it out. You know, life is really not about meaning. It's about living. You know, meaning is an artificial idea. Stories have meaning, but life is bigger than meaning. You know, our problem isn't that our life is meaningless. Our problem is that we're cut off from life. See, it's not that life is meaningless. People say, oh, my life is so meaningless. That is a misinterpretation of the problem. The problem is that we cut ourselves off from that life energy. So meditation is about becoming one with this and this and this and this and this until you encounter that life energy. And then the question of meaning just evaporates. Who cares? This moment is the Buddha. This moment is all we ever have. A monk asked Joshu, what is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming to China? Bodhidharma was the great monk who brought Zen from India to China. What's the meaning? Joshu said, the cypress tree in the garden, this moment. Mumon's comment, if you understand Joshu's answer intimately, there is no Buddha before you, no future Buddha to come. The Buddha is right here. It's not coming. It's you. When you can be in that energy, you are the Buddha. Mumon's verse. Words cannot express things. Speech does not convey the spirit. Swayed by words, one is lost. Blocked by phrases, one is bewildered.